The University Tower Chimes bring in another session of Ask the Professor, the show on which you match wits with University of Detroit Mercy professors in an unrehearsed session of questions and answers. I'm your host, Matt Mayo, and let me introduce to you our panel for today. To my left, drawing on a box of Kleenex, it's Professor Dave Chow.
Pleasure to be here. I'm working for Heather right about now. That's awesome.
What are you drawing, though? I don't have glasses on.
People being miserable.
Oh, that's
fantastic. It's the official UDM Ask the Professor tissue box.
Dan Maggio, have you escaped most of this winter not getting particularly ill?
To answer your question, it's been a miserable winter.
Well, I was hoping Stephanie would be here to give us the final 411, because in my discussion with her yesterday, she confirms, as an immunologist, so someone who should know, mild fall means there wasn't enough freezing, there wasn't enough moisture to kill all the things that usually just live all around us. And so they're circulating greater than ever before.
Yeah, no doubt.
Professor Jason Roach is here. Successfully avoiding any illness this fine season?
So far, so good.
All right, keep it real. Wash those hands.
Many, many times a day.
Yes. In the immortal words of Mark Benvenuto, if we could travel back in time to medieval times, we'd be gods and live to 50 if we washed our hands. He's absolutely right. Absolutely right. Professor Jim Tubbs is here.
Hello.
We've heard from him. How are you doing?
Good. Good.
Excellent. Professor Kendra Evans is here, and even though I know you've had a couple of sniffles, it's more your family that's endured.
The kiddos.
Yes. Heather's here as well.
Hello.
Hello, how are you?
I'm okay.
I already know your illness story, so yes. We're just going to move right on.
Yes, what other ailments can we introduce around
the actually, could I ask the panel and all of our lovely listeners to say a small and silent prayer that most of my bulbs come up?
Oh, yes.
Sure, yeah.
You know, yes. Because how many did I plant?
700.
Thank you for
And I am praying because I want to come over.
I want to see them.
Yes, seriously.
Well, will you invite us?
Well, if they come up and look decent, but I just thought I should put a nice little hopeful mention of spring into our conversation.
Okay, they're iris and what else?
I did not do iris.
Oh, you didn't do iris.
I did daffodils and tulips.
Oh, nice.
Wonderful. 60 watts and 75 watts.
Well, you know, if this weather keeps up, they might be out by Easter.
Yeah.
It's true.
Mm-hmm. I always worry when it gets warm like this because things start to come up.
Uh-huh.
That's right.
And then freeze again.
Yeah. Yep.
A couple years ago, a few years ago, the year without apple blossoms in Michigan, not a good thing.
We seem to be very chatty.
Oh, let's get to a question.
Oh, yeah. This is a program where you can send us questions regarding anything. And if you stump the panel, you win one of our prizes. And if you don't stump the panel, you win one of our prizes. Send the questions to us in a number of ways. You can email us at atp@udmercy.edu. You can reach us on the web at udmercy.edu/atp. You can tweet at us using @AskTheProfUDM or #AskTheProfUDM on Twitter, or find us on Facebook. We've got some questions here because it is a question and answer show. Dear professors, I want to properly thank everybody that needs thanking for the awesome coffee mug I received in the mail.
Oh, cool.
In all sincerity, I was both honored and pleased. As a result, I want to send in a new batch of questions, but I wanted to send in good and hopefully fun questions.
We'll be the judge of that.
It took me quite a while to come up with 10 questions, which qualified as both semi-challenging and interesting. But here's what I came up with. The topics range from pop culture, politics, history, the supernatural, and even the unsolved mysteries of unsolved mysteries. 6 out of 10 is passing, extremely generous. And I apologize again for taking so long to get around to thanking everybody up at UDM for the mug. Sincerely, Andrew Wellman of Gulfport, Florida.
Thanks
a lot, Andrew, for sending us questions before, during, and after the game. 1971, Irene Bolam, a 66-year-old Monroe Township, New Jersey resident, filed a $1.5 million defamation lawsuit in response to a book that had been published the previous year, 1971. The book's publisher, McGraw-Hill, would eventually reach an undisclosed settlement with Miss Bolam and pull the book from the shelves. What was Miss Bolam's problem with the book?
A typo?
No. Oh,
darn.
That would have
plagiarism?
No, it wasn't plagiarism.
Bad illustration.
This is one of those things that people used to get away with, I'd say 50s, 60s, 70s, maybe a little bit the 80s, but it's harder to do now because we just have so much information.
Outright lying?
What was that?
Outright lies?
Outright lies, yeah, but which book is it? What was the lie?
Is it we're looking for defamation of character?
Not character. How about wrongful attribution? Does that help a little bit? I'll give you a hint. The name of the book was Amelia Earhart Lives.
I'm just thinking Luggage.
Oh, wow. I thought that was a complete giveaway.
Oh, that was her name?
They misidentified
her? Her name was Irene Bolam.
They claimed she was really Amelia Earhart?
This author claimed this person was Amelia Earhart and caused her horrible trauma as a result.
I was thinking she might know.
Oh, I never heard of that story.
The way it goes is the book claimed Miss Bolam was in fact the famed aviator who disappeared July 2nd, 1937. Bolam died in 1982 after having provided substantial legal documentation of her life, conclusively establishing to everyone she was not, in fact, Amelia Earhart.
Bizarre.
I can't believe a publisher
she has never flown a Lockheed
proof.
Electra in her
without
life.
Checking that.
So it feels like it's one of those books where if we got our hands on it, like the whole book is all conjecture and wild accusation, and then like last paragraph, last chapter, Miss Irene Bolam.
There she is.
Oh, man, that is the weirdest thing I've
ever
heard.
At least she wasn't living in Area 51.
Yes, could always be worse. That's probably where Amelia Earhart is.
Interesting. Or the Bermuda Triangle.
In 1991, Anthony Hopkins won the Best Actor Oscar for his portrayal of Dr. Hannibal Lecter in The Silence of the Lambs, setting a record that still stands. His entire performance in the film comprised less than how many minutes of screen time?
10 minutes?
16.
16 minutes. Yep. Less than any other Oscar-winning role before or since. Conversely, which Oscar-winning performance in a supporting role was afforded the greatest amount of screen time? That would be the Mirror Image, right? It would be a supporting role, but the most amount of screen time.
Was it Jodie Foster in the same movie?
No, it's not. It's not. Because I would say she was the lead.
Was it Christopher Weitz from...
You're right.
I think that's his last name. The one from...
Breaking...
Inglourious Basterds.
No, nope. No. Right. 1974, Best Supporting Actress.
Was it the Deer Hunter?
No. Nope.
Angelica Houston?
Nope.
Four.
Okay.
67 minutes for a supporting actress.
Hopefully the guy was hourly rate.
Oh, was it The Graduate?
No. I will give one more hint, and then I think we're going to have to go over
Jane Fonda?
On this one. This actress was 10 years old in this
movie. Oh, Paper Moon.
Yep.
Tatum O'Neill.
Tatum O'Neill. There you go. Very well done.
That was the supporting role?
Yeah, she was in the whole movie.
Actress. Yep. Crazy. I love these are we're only two questions in and I'm just smiling ear to ear.
So we're in trouble.
July 21st, 2010. President Barack Obama signed into law the Dodd-Frank Wall Street Reform and Consumer Protection Act. One provision of the bill was informally named for a popular American comedian. Who was it and why?
These are great questions.
These are fantastic questions.
I'm going to go with Chris Rock.
No. I tell you what though, but if Chris Rock had sort of a comedic father or uncle, we'd be on the right track here.
Eddie Murphy?
It's the Eddie Murphy section of the document.
No, it's not.
Section 746. After congressional testimony by the chief of the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, noting that a ban on using misappropriated government information to trade in the commodity markets would finally criminalize a key plot point of trading places.
That's a great movie.
1983. That's wonderful. Yes, that was the Eddie Murphy rule. Oh, my gosh. That's fantastic. Absolutely
I was waiting for
fantastic.
A Golden Child take or something.
No.
Sorry, Dan. Sorry.
Oh, my. You can think of any other horrible...
I knew you were going to go there.
What is it? I always say the nerdy professor, but it's
the nutty professor.
The nutty professor, yes. In which he played all the roles.
Exactly.
Was Ralph Bellamy in that movie?
He was.
Yes.
Was
he? Trading Places, yes, he was.
And Don Amici.
Yep, Dan Aykroyd, Jamie Lee Curtis.
Yeah, Trading Places was a great movie.
In 2011, the New Hampshire Division of Historical Resources erected a historical marker near U.S. Route 3 in Lincoln, New Hampshire, the site of an incident in 2011, 50 years earlier, involving an area couple. What does this marker commemorate?
UFO sighting.
It was not the...
Indeed,
the Hindenburg?
It was Barney and Betty Hill, the first Americans ever to report being abducted by a UFO.
No!
And...
I got it.
If you've never seen the movie based on that event, just go and Netflix it or whatever.
Their last name is Hill?
Their last name was Hill. Wow. They were an interracial couple. And it made it very difficult for the media to even bring to the fore with a black man and a white woman being married. Isn't that incredible? For 50 years before 2011, I can't do the math.
61?
This is the 70s?
Oh, we're all kind of foggy.
60s. The Hills were the first Americans ever to report being abducted by a UFO.
1961. Yes.
The marker's text reads, on the night of 19 September 1961, Portsmouth, New Hampshire couple Betty and Barney Hill experienced a close encounter with an unidentified flying object and 2 hours of lost time driving on Route 3. They filed an official Air Force Project Blue Book report of a brightly lit cigar-shaped craft the next day, but were not public about their story until it was leaked to the Boston Traveler 4 years later. This is the first widely reported UFO abduction report in the United States of America.
Wow.
I remember the film very well because in my youth is when
it came
out. That
was the film Close Encounters of the Third Kind?
It was not. It was way before that is the point. And Barney is played by James Earl Jones. Ooh. And so, you know, as a kid, I'm like, oh, Darth Vader.
What's the name of the movie?
I don't remember the name of the movie. I don't remember the name of the movie.
Speaking of UFOs, who's been watching The X-Files?
It's wonderful, and I
absolutely
love it.
Yep.
And I can't get over it. It's so awesome.
Yeah, it's good. It's funny. It's
well,
good.
How do you
it's
think
good.
It compares to the original?
I love the original.
Oh, I do too.
Yeah, I was in love with
the first one I saw.
Dana Scully's character did so much for women and science.
Yep.
I just
absolutely.
I love it.
We talk in recent years until this reboot about the fact that Dana Scully on the show, not actually Gillian Anderson, has a tattoo on her ankle that is the Ouroboros, the snake biting its own tail, which is the symbol of infinity. We use this all the time in organic chemistry to describe reactions where you make a ring by that happening. And I'm like, oh, it's back on TV. I can use the reference again.
Is that the tattoo that she actually gets in one of the episodes?
Yes.
Is it that snake?
Exactly.
Yeah, when, with that snake weird guy. And Jodie Foster was in that episode.
Yes.
She's the voice. Okay, anyway, we could do X-Files trivia.
If someone wants to send some X-Files trivia, that'd be great.
Mark?
I just like the fact that there's bigger budget for it right now. That's all.
Yes.
The special effects are much better.
It's going to be over, I think. One more episode?
Yeah, but I'm
more episode.
I bet they make another limited run.
They're testing the water.
They'll be back.
No, they did the right thing by making only 6. We don't need 20 episodes or anything.
No.
Just whet our appetite.
The only thing that got me a little upset was Gillian Anderson was not offered the equal contract to David Duchovny.
Are you kidding me?
They offered her like peanuts comparatively. Well, she held out. And they finally agreed to it.
That's horrible.
But that was just like, come on.
One of the episodes, it's honestly not giving that much away, is absolute rip on some sort of weird humanoid, animaloid, weird creature being bit by a human and becoming a werehuman.
Yes.
And he's very upset that he has to go into this human form whenever the moon is full. It's a really, really good story.
That episode, and then we'll get back to the real questions.
Oh, yeah.
That creature that becomes a man is actually wearing the suit that Kolchak wore Night Stalker, which of course was inspiration for Chris Carter for The X-Files.
That's right. That's right.
So,
you know, I used to watch that show, Night Stalker. That's a great, great show.
We have some of them now.
That was before my
time, but my husband knows about them, so we've watched a few of them. They're weird and creepy.
Between that and In Search Of, it's pretty easy to watch TV at night.
All right, enough.
All right,
sorry.
All right. That's all right. We'll go on here.
Bad flashbacks.
6th of May, 1978, First Lady Rosalind Carter shook hands and posed for photographs with what infamous serial killer?
Charles Manson?
Ted Bundy.
Mm-mm.
Mr. T?
Ted Kaczynski?
Mrs. Carter was in Chicago
on death row, somebody
to
that
celebrate
she was trying to pardon?
Polish Constitution Day, and she was introduced to the director of the Polish Constitution Day Parade.
John Wayne Gacy.
Oh.
In 1980, when Gacy stood trial for a total of 33 murders, his lawyers listed Mrs. James Carter, White House, Washington, D.C., as a potential defense witness.
I don't think so.
Oh, my gosh. Because you got a picture taken with somebody once? That's kind of weird. I don't know. That feels odd and out of the ordinary.
And weren't you the one that, like, played a clown at
a lot of birthday parties? His paintings are scary too.
Actually,
before he was convicted, she shook his hand.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Yep. There's already something going on at that point.
Good fertilizer. I don't want to know if those bulbs come up.
Hey, I see 33 murders, you know, on the legal docket, and I'm like, how many more are there? What record album, released in 1963, is universally considered to be the rarest of all collectible music?
Is it somebody who died right after the release?
No. It's actually a very, very famous sort of 60s era singer. And I'll be honest, he's in commercials now talking to a computer.
Bob Dylan?
It's Bob Dylan. Yes, the freewheeling Dylan. That's right. Somehow reached the market containing four songs that were not actually included in the final version of the album. It's estimated that fewer than 20 of these copies in mono, of course. Their current value is $15,000. And only two copies, $35,000 are known to exist. For the record, no pun intended, the four songs all written by Dylan are Rocks and Gravel, Let Me Die in My Footsteps, Ramblin' Gamblin' Willie, and Talkin' John Birch Paranoid Blues, classic Dylan titles.
I could see, I could see collecting it. I'm not sure I could see listening to it.
Why do you
this
say that?
This is a comic book to put on your put away shelf. Yes, exactly.
Yeah,
I don't know how I got introduced to. And I see that Dave is going to do maybe a little bit of Bob Dylan.
I'm just drunk about it. Oh, okay. Sorry.
But one of my buddies was learning guitar, and he's like, "Check out this song," and the title was like Bob Dylan's 725th Dream.
Oh, Lord.
There's been a lot of songs this guy's done. Let me tell you. Out of all the various components of the United States Armed Forces that were active in World War II, which service suffered the highest casualty?
The Marine Corps?
The Army.
Hold on.
It says, it's difficult because, you know, even at that time, we didn't really have an Air Force, right? Yeah. We had Army Air Force.
Merchant Marines.
The Merchant Marines is what it says here. Yeah. 733 U.S. cargo ships were, oh my gosh, that's a big number.
Well, there was such a slow start in protecting them. There was a piece on the History Channel the other night about that because the German submarines, right after we got into the war, just went up and down the East Coast, and they could see the ships silhouetted against the lights of the shore. And one guy just stationed himself right outside New York Harbor, and you could see all of the skyscrapers and all the ships. You know,
sitting ducks.
Yeah.
Yeah, it says that was a total of 8,651 U.S. Merchant Marines. That's a very, very high casualty rate. In 1973, 4 years after cancellation of the TV show Star Trek, many of the show's original cast members reunited to provide their voices for an animated version of the show, which aired Saturday mornings on NBC.
Yes. Really?
Over the course of 2 seasons and only 22 episodes, the cartoon version of Star Trek managed to notch an achievement which the original live-action version of the show was never able to attain.
An Emmy.
Yeah, it was an Emmy. That's right. Despite being nominated 13 times, the original live-action Star Trek never won an Emmy. However, in 1975, the animated version of Star Trek beat out the Pink Panther show and Captain Kangaroo to win the Daytime Emmy Award for Outstanding Entertainment Children's Series.
Horrible animation, too.
It was the worst animation. It looked like it was being drawn as it was airing.
I still watch them, so I don't remember.
You haven't
missed them. Jimmy Doohan did like a bunch of the voices.
Oh, he did. He was a very good voice actor in that show. Yep.
He
was also missing a chunk of his finger.
And if you want to prepare yourself for like the next generation of how that might happen in 2016, there is a rumor, which apparently has been confirmed, that the very last 5 minutes of the last episode of this season's Simpsons, they're going to put Dan Castellaneta in a motion capture suit and allow him to be Homer Simpson on TV live, animated, which I find
really
absolutely
cool.
Fascinating. I think that's really cool. So people are going to tweet at him, and he's going to respond to, you know, the sort of things that that come his way. Jimmy Hoffa, one-time president of the International Brotherhood of Teamsters, was last seen on 30 July 1975 at the Macus Red Fox, a restaurant located at 15 Mile, that's Maple Road and Telegraph in Bloomfield Hills, Michigan. While it's commonly believed that Hoffa went to the restaurant intending to meet with two mafia officials, both of whom remain prime suspects in Hoffa's disappearance, the FBI determined early in its investigation it was unlikely Hoffa actually planned to dine at the Red Fox. Why?
Because he'd already eaten.
But this is close. It's not it, but this is close. This is close.
He had other dinner plans.
He had a reservation somewhere else.
No.
He got tipped off?
No.
He had a stomach ache?
He never eats lunch.
I remember hearing
he
this
didn't like
as
the
a
chef?
Bit of urban legendism from when I was very, very young.
Mm. He had Burger King?
He just, he didn't like the chef? Or the...
Nope. The FBI had a January 1976, so that would have been just about 6 months later. They called it the Hoffex Memo. And what they found is that what?
He became a vegetarian.
When
they found
really
his body
close.
And did the autopsy, there was no food in the stomach?
No, the problem is they never found the body, right?
He didn't order anything.
No. All of the investigations indicated he never intended to go to the restaurant because the Macus Red Fox required a suit and tie, which he was not wearing at the time.
Oh, that's awesome.
Isn't that wild? Just absolutely wonderful questions from Andrew Wellman. Look, Andrew, you can send us questions as often as you want when you do this level of research. These are totally cool. I seriously feel like I'm living an X-Files episode right now. It's kind of cool. We only have one more, unfortunately. Oh. And we beat the 6 out of 10 hardcore.
Barely.
Oh, man. On November 18th, 1985, daytime talk show host Phil Donahue made a special guest appearance on a Watershed episode of another long-running TV show. What was the show and what was the occasion?
Different Strokes. They always had guest stars.
Facts of Life. He was
85?
No, 85.
Was it on That Girl? He did end up marrying her.
I have to reveal.
The Cosby Show?
That at least...
Jerry Springer. He was on Jerry Springer. He threw a chair. No?
Oh, the Today Show?
It was none of these shows you've mentioned.
Darn.
Is it a new show?
I feel like I kind of grew up with Phil Donahue. My mom may or may not have been obsessed with watching Donahue.
My mom was too.
But he was like Mr. Just the Facts. We're just trying to get to the nitty gritty of what's actually going on here.
He's on Dragnet?
So if I tell you that he appeared on a kid's show, what
Sesame
do you think?
Street.
Yeah, yes.
Street.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Because?
He was going to rough up Oscar. Oh. he had to prove the... Snuffleupagus was real?
Okay. He didn't believe Big Bird. There was no evidence that Mr. Snuffleupagus was real. And then finally, on that date, adults met Mr. Snuffleupagus, which the modern kids would never know that he was never actually seen by adults back in the day.
Oh, yep. So he didn't believe in Big Bird?
No, he didn't believe Big Bird saying that his friend existed.
Oh, okay.
And he was the truth teller, right?
Gotcha.
Ha ha.
Crazy, crazy stuff.
That's deep.
All right, Heather's going to get up and leave when I say we'll go back to some questions about
winter.
You said you didn't like the winter questions.
I don't know. They're just kind of giving me the doldrums.
Well, I'm sorry. Let's finish them up.
Who's sprung these on us?
Old Man Winter.
Old Man Winter, send them in. Yep.
Okay. Some are good, right?
Summer.
If you're going to fall for that one.
Couples are more than twice as likely to think about splitting up. Between end of year holidays and
Valentine's Day.
Nightfall?
Day.
Oh, absolutely. Valentine's Day. Yes.
Why is that?
Dark. Who studies this stuff? And miserable.
And the bills come due.
Yes. Oh, yeah, that's true. That's definitely true. Okay. We've had this before in a million different ways, but it's good just to throw back out there because
many snowflakes.
No.
The world's largest snowflake.
But if we think about things that happen during winter, the most common birthday. In the United States, is what month, what date?
September. September something.
March 5.
It's not March 5th.
November.
September, we have had this before.
March 13th?
No, didn't we have this?
Well, that's.
I thought it was like.
We've talked about this before because if you know, if you're thinking retroactively.
Oh. Yeah, let's back it up 9 months
to
what
event.
9 months.
It was September.
It's definitely September.
September.
9 months after the Super Bowl.
The 9th.
It's September 16th is the most common birthday in the United States of America. So, yes.
Happy New Year, honey. Ha ha. Wink, wink,
I wonder if it's statistically significant or if it just happens to be the most. Who sent that in? Ask them if they could research.
Old Man Winter.
I don't quite know. Let's see. Can you guys name?
No, we can't.
An animal that possesses the amazing ability to turn its fur white. But only during the winter.
Rabbit.
Arctic hare is what it's called. Oh, sorry. Arctic fox. Everybody knows the ptarmigan.
Of course.
Of course.
But three in the yard.
What about caribou? The snow weasel?
And actually the ermine was the last one. So yeah, okay. you got it. You got
what's
the weasel.
An ermine?
Thumbs up on weasel,
weasel
actually.
Weasel.
Did you say weasel?
You guessed snow weasel.
Got a lot of them in Russia.
That was really good.
You were like jumping. I said weasel.
But ptarmigans, that's feathers though.
I guess I don't know what that is.
It's a grouse.
A grouse?
Yeah, PT, you know, it's one of those god awful spelling bee questions.
I'm feeling doldrumish.
Oh my.
Doldritic.
Oh my gosh.
Doldritic.
Okay. Industry experts note that colder than usual winters probably don't reduce the number of blank
illnesses
in
viruses.
The following spring and summer. No, not illnesses.
Mosquitoes.
Bugs, yeah, insects. Yes, absolutely.
They what would don't. Have, it doesn't.
It does not affect it.
Oh.
What would have more of an impact on the numbers would be an out-of-season cold snap because the insects have not yet adapted to the current environmental change. So
or
we can always
DDT,
hope for that.
But we don't use that anymore.
I hesitate to bring this up. I hesitate to bring this up because I would have to inject a modicum of seriousness into our show.
Oh, please, what? Please.
But if you want some serious, like, eye-opening stuff when it comes to why we should be caring about Zika virus, it's not just about the fact that it's been around for a while and the media is just grabbing onto it now. The true story is this guy from some university in the Midwest who's tracking the species of mosquito that can spread it. And this scared the pants off of me when I heard it the other day. It says, the difference is no longer empty your bird feeder, no standing water in your backyard. These mosquitoes live without water in homes in Brazil.
Lovely.
And you're about to bring all these people to the Olympics there. Oh. They're going to grab a couple mosquito eggs and they're going to send it back across the entire earth. And these mosquitoes can live with human beings at ambient temperature and pressure. And that freaked me out for a little
bit. I'm turning on the air conditioning.
So, yeah. Enjoy. Something like that. Yeah.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Sorry.
You really inspired us.
Taking me out of the doldrums.
Oh, my
gosh.
Oh, here's one that'll make Heather very happy.
Uh-oh.
Some plants, both annual and perennial, require vernalization to flower. What does this refer to?
Vernalization. Well, exposure to spring.
Is that no, cold. They have to be like
They have to be cold first.
Cold,
they have to be cold first before they can go. Vernus does mean of the spring, but the spring has to follow the winter.
Yep. Is that like winter wheat?
I'm not sure if that's what it means.
Yeah. It's like there's certain types
bulbs.
Of seeds that, like, if you want to start something from seed, you actually have to put it in the freezer for put them in the freezer
you
for
have to
a
trick
while.
Them.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Researchers believe this ensures seed production begins always in spring, instead of being fooled into making seeds
nice
in the fall.
To fool Mother Nature.
That's right.
Thank you. That makes me a little happier.
It's cool. Well, we're actually, you know, we're definitely getting into a more spring-like direction with these questions. This Chinese plant is one of the very few plants that bloom in the dead of winter, making it the beloved of Chinese art and poetry.
Lotus? Mm-mm. No, sorry.
Is it a cactus?
Bonsai?
Nope. It's actually
I don't know if that's Japanese.
It's a fruit.
Fruit?
Cherry blossom?
Nope. It's the Chinese plum.
As well. Oh, Chinese plum. Dave doesn't know what that is.
Well,
my Canadianness took over.
Oh.
The time has come, unfortunately, for us to say goodbye, Professor Hill Vasquez.
Think spring.
Professor Evans.
Take care.
Professor Tubbs.
I'm thinking spring.
Professor Roach.
See you real soon.
Professor Maggio.
Goodbye.
Professor Chow.
See ya.
And now these words.
You can email Ask the Professor at atp@udmercy.edu. Tweet to us on Twitter at Ask the Professor or using the hashtag AskTheProfessorUDM. Or visit the Ask the Professor Facebook page.
Ask the Professor is transcribed at the facilities of the Briggs Building in the Department of Communication Studies in the College of Liberal Arts and Education at the University of Detroit Mercy's McNichols campus. Ask the Professor is produced and directed by Michael Jason, and our executive producer is Dr. Vivian Dix. Until next week, I'm your host, Matt Mayo.